This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit chevrolet.gm.ca.
Will Ferguson is a two-time winner of the Leacock Medal for Humor. His new novel is entitled Spanish Fly. It's inspired in part by his family's history. It's the history of a path not taken. Spanish Fly is a story of con men and call girls, the art of the con, all set against the dust storms of the Great Depression. Will Ferguson is in our Calgary studio. Hi, Will.
Hi, Drew. How are you doing?
Well, I'm not allowed to complain.
Good. It won't do you any good anyway.
I know. It's in my contract. So the title, Spanish Fly, that's pretty provocative.
Yeah, it comes from an actual con that they used to run. Real Spanish Fly, I should explain, is used to...
It's an aphrodisiac, a theoretical aphrodisiac, isn't it?
Yeah, emphasis on the theoretical, because it's actually a beetle. It's not even a fly, and it's used to... It irritates the urinary tract, and it's used to incite breeding among livestock. So it's not quite as romantic as it sounds. It's actually a poison. But that doesn't stop people from selling authentic, 100% genuine placebo Spanish fly, because most people don't know what placebo is. So the con men in the novel sell genuine placebos to people, and they work.
Well, as the intro says, it's a story about con men.
I should explain that my father, the character Jack McGreery, the main character, is about a 19-year-old boy who falls in with a pair of ne'er-do-well con men, con artists named Virgil and Miss Rose, and they go on a road trip and just a crime spree across the West until everything catches up on them. But the character Jack McGreery is based loosely on my father, Jack Ferguson, who wasn't a con man, but who knew an awful lot about con men and grifters, suspiciously so. We never quite got to the bottom of that.
Interesting. And it's a story of a path not taken. Can you explain that?
Well, I'm a Ferguson out of St. Kilda, which are these little tiny islands on the Outer Hebrides of Britain. They're kind of the farthest place you can go in the British Isles, and then you hit Iceland. And they migrated to Glasgow, and then from Glasgow they came over to Cape Breton. And my grandfather worked in the coal mines in Cape Breton. It was a cave-in that killed several of his brothers, and he just walked away. And the family legend is that he flipped a coin, whether to see whether he would stay on British territory, as Canada was considered then, or go south into the United States. And the coin, I always like to imagine it in dramatically, you know, teetered on the edge before it fell. But it landed in Canada's favor, so he stayed in Canada. He went on the CNR, went west, settled in Western Canada. And my father grew up in the Dust Bowl, the northern reaches of the Dust Bowl. So I've always wondered about the other side of the coin. You must get that, Drew. Like, we wonder about the things you didn't do. Like, how would it have panned out? And I've always wondered about the family, the history that didn't happen, if that coin had fallen the other way. So this novel is kind of my dad's story from the other side of the coin. And ironically, without giving away the ending, it brings it all back to Canada anyway.
Well, in reading the book, as you said, there's an awful lot of conning going on in there. And I remember reading it. There's just one con after another, all these different types, almost like there's a hierarchy. And you almost need a rule book to understand what's going on. What kind of research did you do?
Well, I just found it fascinating, con. I wanted to write as an author, Drew, that when people ask you, you have the real answer, then you have the true answer, right? When people ask you, why did you write this? And you always say, I wanted to talk about man's inhumanity to man. I want to, like, you have the kind of the answer, the public answer. But the real answer for me is I wanted to write the ultimate con man novel with every con. So I researched, I read a lot of biographies of classic con men, Canada Bill, Yellow Kid Wheel, Count Lustig, Cassie Chadwick, all these great con men and con women of the 20s and 30s. That was really the golden age of the con. This is, you know...
Well, it's the era of the Sting, right?
Yeah, it was the same kind of era. Now, the Sting, the movie The Sting is based on a book called The Long Con by David Maurer. And that's a different kind of ball of wax. That's the big, elaborate con. I want to do the small rolling, kind of like rolling thunder, you know, one con after another hitting towns, and the con's getting more elaborate and more dangerous as they go on. I wanted that sense. Now, if you ask me at a writer's festival, I'll say, well, I wanted to examine man's inhumanity to man. That would be the official answer. But really, I wanted to write kind of the ultimate con man novel.
Oh, you're just in it for the money, admit it.
Well, I'm in it for the fun. I wanted to have fun writing it. My theory is that if you don't have fun writing it, they sure as hell won't have fun reading it.
True, true. Have you ever tried any of the cons yourself?
Not really. See, it's funny because people have asked me, maybe when you're with this novel, you should show people how to do three-card Monty. Well, if I knew how to do three-card Monty, I wouldn't be writing books for a living. I'd be doing three-card Monty. Right. So unfortunately, I don't have the nimble fingers. I did realize, though, as I was researching it, though, that I was taken by a con. It's called change raising. I don't want to explain how it does because I don't want to aid and abet any would-be con artist out there.
Is this the $10 into 20?
Yes, yes. You know this one. So you know this, Drew.
I read your book.
Oh, come on. You haven't practiced it. Have you ever been tempted to, I don't want to explain how to do it. Like I said, I really don't want to be responsible for some poor hapless clerk out there being stung.
Well, my question is, does it work with Canadian Tire money?
No, but I did hear about a con guy in Florida several years ago who was passing off Canadian Tire money as real tender and getting away with it. He'd say that Sandy McTire was the king of Canada or something. But so a lot of it, well, they call it cons because it's confidence.
Right,
and that's the key, is you have to be able to look someone right in the eye. Well, I don't have that. I always waver at the last moment.
Well, I think also a lot of us are familiar with the con coming from the traveling carnivals, because I've gone in, I've picked a little rubber duck thinking I'll win something or pulled the little string, and you never win.
It's funny, isn't it, how you never win? You'd almost think it was stacked against you. You'd almost think the entire thing was rigged.
Who'd have thunk
it? Carnivals are funny. The best definition I ever heard of humor is Lee Cox said that humor exists in that strange gap between our aspirations and our achievements, you know, between the real world and what we expect. And it dawned on me that that's where con men and carnival men ply their trade, is that gap between what we dream, like you pulling the string, Drew, and thinking, I'm going to win. And there's the reality behind it. They really ply false dreams and false hopes. So in a way, they're very New World figures. You know, they're very North American kind of 1920s self-invented figures.
And it all comes down to greed?
Greed and need. Greed, need, and fear. Those are the three combinations. Those are the key.
I guess the contemporary version would be all those Nigeria emails.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that it took me a while to figure this out, because I'll tell you the one thing that was odd for me is you read about these cons where they sell some beat-up fiddle as a Stradivarius, and you think, they're so outlandish. Who falls for this stuff? You know, how can you fall for this? But it dawned on me that outlandish cons work because they're outlandish. They're so far beyond your frame of reference. You can't compare them to anything. And you and I do not deal daily with Nigerian exile diplomats, I'm guessing. At least I know I don't.
There's not a lot of them on my reserve.
That's right. I imagine there's not, yeah. So when someone emails you about this, you know, great, that this Nigerian exile diplomat wants to move millions of dollars, it's so out of your world. It's so beyond your frame of reference. You can't compare it to anything. The Nigerian email scam is actually about 500 years old.
Well, when I was reading your book, the Drake subplot just immediately reminded me of that.
Yeah, and the Nigerian email scam, of course not with email, goes back right to the Spanish Armada.
Mm-hmm.
And they would send letters out to British noblemen saying, I am the daughter, usually the beautiful daughter, of a imprisoned British nobleman rotting in a Spanish prison cell. And if you give us some money to bribe the guards, we will reward you with millions of gold bullion. But the thing is, it's really just an advance payment scheme. That's all it is. It's an elaborate, anytime someone contacts you, saying you've won a prize or you have a potential payoff, but you need money up front, that's a scam. It's called an advance payment scam. And what they do is they cloud your eyes with millions of dollars, and all you have to do is hand over $5,000, not realizing that you're never going to get the $1 million. So the most elaborate cons often come down to a very basic principles. It's kind of like magic that way. Magic operates on about four or five principles.
Right, right. Well, I know, like, I work in theater a lot, and I know one of the big cons in the world of theater is trying to get an agent who said, I need $500 to do your 8x10s, do up a proper bio, stuff like that. Send me that, and I can make you a star.
It's exactly the same scam. It's exactly that, because your eyes get clouded with Hollywood and stars and movies and that. You don't realize that all you're really being asked to do, if you boil it down, is to give someone money. That's all that's really happening. And it's funny how people, you know, we live in dreamland, don't we? I mean, we kind of exist with heads full of dreams and aspirations and goals. And con men are kind of intuitive psychologists. They know how to take advantage of that, how to really exploit that.
It's hard to be a stupid con man, I take it.
No, exactly. Con men, what you don't want, you have to be very intelligent, but you don't want a lot of empathy. Yeah. You can't have empathy for other people. And con men are usually intelligent, but they're very kind of distant. You know, they're not socially involved with other people.
You were earlier talking about how it deals with dreams. What's your dream, Will?
Oh, my dream? At this point, my dream is to make one big novel sale and then retire to the to some warm island. I think that's what most people's dreams are.
Cape Breton?
That's right, the sunny skies of Cape Breton. So I actually, you know, here's something that what I would dream of. I've always dreamed of being a singer. And I've only been held back by one, you know, tiny detail, which is that I cannot sing.
That little thing called talent.
Yes, other than talent, except for that one little niggling detail, I think I could have been a star. Well, and I've taken a whack at songwriting.
Yes, I know. There's a soundtrack associated with this book, which I find very unusual. You hear about soundtracks with films and things like that, but you've actually managed to put together the official soundtrack to the book Spanish Fly. How did that happen?
Well, this, you know, all my best ideas come when I'm drinking beer. I swear to God. I swear, you know, Archimedes, Einstein, they were drinking beer. I swear to God. Because I was at the Ironwood Saloon in Calgary, Alberta, and I was listening to Tom Phillips play. And he's a honky-tonk, kind of urban honky-tonk band in Calgary. Tom Phillips is a well-known singer-songwriter. And I was listening to him play, and I was having a beer with the head of sales for the publisher, and I was listening to this music, and I thought, you know, why is it, exactly like you said, why do movies get soundtracks and novels don't get soundtracks? And I had another beer, another glass of inspiration, and I thought, you know, if this novel had a soundtrack, it would be Tom Phillips. So we grabbed Tom between sets, and I don't know what we were saying to him, but I was telling him, we have this novel, you got to write a soundtrack, it'll be a first, it's never been done.
This is the first time you've met him?
No, I've known Tom, actually. I do know Tom. I've known him, but this is the first time I told him about it. We just kind of launched at him, and he knows me well enough to know that...
You like beer.
Yes, and that my ideas often, as though they sound crazy, often make sense in the long run. And Tom went for it, and he wrote... It's a Tom Phillips CD, I should emphasize it. So it's not like a... It's a Tom Phillips CD called Spanish Fly, the soundtrack to the novel. And I wrote there's 15 tracks, and I did 3 of the songs. So, I mean, I wrote the lyrics, and Tom put them to music. And as an author, Drew, I have to tell you, I am now envious and respectful of songwriters, because you know what it's like. It can take you 100 pages to get to an emotional payoff.
Right.
It can work forever to get to that point. Tom can do it in 3 minutes, 30 seconds. So I think my dream is to pack up the novel writing and become a songwriter. That's where the real storytelling is. It's kind of emotional storytelling condensed and concentrated.
Maybe that's why they get all the girls.
Yeah, that's got to be what it is, yeah. Actually, it was funny, you know, Drew, someone asked me once what the best thing about doing a literary reading is and what's the worst thing. And I always tell them the best thing about doing an author reading are all the groupies that turn out. And the worst thing is the fact that these groupies are purely imaginary. Other than that, life is good.
Yes, I got into theater for the money and the groupies.
That's right. And I'm still waiting. You misinformed.
I know, I need a new agent.
That's right, don't we all?
So you wrote 3 of the songs.
Yeah, I wrote one called Con Men and Call Girls. Uh-huh. And I was playing this in my car, the CD with my kids. I've got a 9-year-old son, Alex, and a 5-year-old.
Con Men and Call Girls to your 9-year-old son?
Oh, it gets worse. This is only the start. Because they're sponges. I forget that. He's 9 and his little brother, Alistair, is 5. And Tom has a song on the CD called, and I believe this is the ultimate title to a country and western song. It's called Drinking and Cheating and Running Around. And my kids sing this in the car, going, drinking and cheating and running around. And they sing the whole way in, and my wife thought perhaps this was not a good thing to send them off to kindergarten, send them off to school with in their heads. Although my oldest son finally said to me, Dad, Tom, because they know Tom, they love Tom, and they said, Tom, why doesn't he like tall girls? And I was confused. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, he always talks about tall girls in the songs. And I thought, well, do you explain
to
him?
Yes, that's a conversation you might want to have with your son at a later date.
Exactly. Well, what I said was, well, years ago, a tall girl broke Tom's heart, and he's never forgiven them. So in their mind, it's con men and tall girls, and I have not informed them otherwise. So please, Drew, do not tell them.
I read somewhere that you wrote that most writers lazy because they only publish a book every 2 years or so, and you do 2 a year.
Oh, you've been digging up the research on me. This is the biggest regret I ever had, was making that comment. I didn't.
It's followed you, has it?
Oh yes, and thanks to you, Drew, it's now got new legs. I thought I had finally put it to rest. The quote, it's a little bit out of context. What I'd said was early on, because I don't have a day job. Like a fool, as soon as I got my first book contract, I quit my day job. I was working out in Prince Edward Island. I was working at a tour company selling Anne of Green Gables tours to Japanese tourists. So it was a kind of
that
an
old
odd job.
That old chill.
That was, you talk about con jobs right there, man. But I was doing this, and as soon as I got a book contract, I just quit my day job. And we went through some tough years, my wife and I, you know, to get out of it. But the beauty about not having a day job is you got nothing to do but write. And I aim at, basically it's a book a year. As I blot out a year of my life for a book. Sometimes it takes longer, sometimes it takes less. But I think if that's all you have to do, like I don't teach courses, I don't think anybody would want to learn from me, except by what not to do. So in an interview once, I foolishly said, "Yeah, I just mused. You see, Drew, I was musing. I was just musing out loud." And I said,
"Well, I find you amusing."
I said, "I always wonder why." You know, it takes authors like 4 or 5 years because I don't know about you, Drew, but I lose interest after about a year. I can't.
It's hard to sustain an idea for 3 years.
Don't you think? Four years, sometimes 7 years, some of these authors. I don't know how they do it, how they maintain the focus or the interest. And I'm with you on that. I find about a year of my life is all I can really give before my mind starts to wander and I start to get interest in other projects. You know, and that's always the moment you realize you've been doing something too long is when you sit down to write and your mind just kind of immediately drifts off somewhere else. So I made this comment and it has followed me and followed me and followed me. And it's usually presented as though I was being very caustic or critical of other authors. I was honestly just musing.
Well, that's what we get paid the big bucks for,
exactly.
Musing.
That's right.
Now, the book, as it's stated, is a novel about a path not taken. Now, let's talk about the path taken. Your a book called Spanish Flies is a pretty provocative title from a little boy from Fort Vermilion.
That's right, Footner Lake Reserve, Fort Vermilion, up northern Alberta. I'm up. I grew up in a town about 860. How many people are on your res?
800 people.
Oh, so
on a good night.
800 on a good night, yeah. That's right. Well, we had about 860, so we were a metropolis.
Ooh.
Compared to you guys. And my mom worked at there's a St. Teresa Mission Hospital, which was the hospital there. My mom worked up there, and there were six of us growing up there. And we were basically the same latitude as Fort Chip or Churchill, Manitoba, is where we grew up. And we always said we were where the birds turned around and came back. And that's kind of, there's a lot of truth to that. So I always felt I immigrated to Canada. That I moved to Canada when I left Fort Vermilion. I went south. I kind of went into, because I don't really feel I grew up in the Canada that other Canadians share necessarily. It was a very odd place to grow up in, kind of out in the middle of nowhere. If you go further north, you're in the Arctic, and that's romantic, and that's got cachet. But we weren't even in the Arctic. We were just lost in this huge forest. But the good thing that comes out of it is that you really look at it with the eyes of an outsider.
Mm-hmm,
like
mm-hmm.
Canada seemed really odd and really bizarre and really, it seemed like a really quirky and really weird country coming into it because I felt I moved to Canada.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, growing up in that environment in Fort Vermilion, how much did you have to draw from that to your protagonist growing up in the Great Depression in the American Southwest?
Well, the only real thing that was funny is my editor said, and you'll appreciate this coming from a small kind of area, a small town. She said, "Why is he so desperate to leave?" I said, "My God." And she grew up in like Vancouver, of course. So I said, "Well, trust me." So I had to add a scene where he kind of explains. But to me, it's just self-evident that if you grew up in this dusty back row town. To be honest, though, the Spanish Fly doesn't draw a lot from northern Alberta. It draws a lot from my dad growing up and stories he told me about Saskatchewan. Because my dad grew up in the bald prairie of Radville, which is just the dust bowl, the flatness. And it was stories that he told me about. So this novel doesn't draw a lot on my own background, but more on my father's and his tales.
Now, I understand, other than the soundtrack aspect, the other interesting aspect of this novel is the fact that most of the story hinges on two photographs?
Yeah, the photograph on the cover of the novel. I'm kind of a visual learner, a visual guy, and the photograph on the cover is of a... How I look at it, it's a young Jack McGreery striding the mean streets of the Dust Bowl on the prowl, looking for marks to con and to swindle. And there's Miss Roses beside him, and they've spotted a businessman. And this is how I see this photograph. The actual photograph is from the 1940s, and it's the father of a friend of mine, a man named Ralph Olson, who's from Cremona, Alberta, on a farm outside of Cremona. And it's actually a photograph of him as a young boy, I think 19 or 20 years old, in Calgary. And it's a street photographer. They used to take these photographs and then sell them back to you because there was a novelty behind these photos. And I would be over at Kirsten's house, And I look at this photo on the wall, and every time I looked, I thought, this is a brilliant photo. It just looked like, it was like a window into that world. So I had that photo with me when I wrote it. That was the kind of what I was trying to get at.
Right.
And Mr. Olson was very kind enough to let us use the photo on the cover, even though he is, I stress, not a con man in any way, although his photo is splashed across a book about con men. And the other photograph is of a young boy and a mother lost in a dust storm, which is just heartbreaking. And we put that at the end of the book. And that was from the earlier part of the novel, where you learn about how Jack grew up and how he lost his mother. So I used those two photos just to try to give me a sense of those times, because I did not grow up in the plains. I did not grow up in the Dust Bowl. I did not grow up in the 30s. So it was just a way to try to connect with that. It was just a little trick, I guess. Yeah. You know, you kind of keep it near your computer when you're writing.
Well, yeah, I think all writers use some sort of visual cues.
Yeah, yeah, they really kind of inform the entire process, I guess.
So what's next for Will Ferguson?
What's next is a lot of sleep. I just finished, I think it was 11 towns in 3 weeks, you know, because the thing about writing a book is that you're not just competing with other novelists. You're competing with the internet, the 500-channel universe. You're competing with YouTube. You're competing with magazines. And there's so much static out there, it's really hard to get your book through. And that applies to any of the arts, whether it's poetry or theater or novels.
So you're going to take a breather from writing.
That's right. I'm working on the next one. It'll be a travel book, a travel narrative.
You've done several of those, haven't you?
Yeah, I like to alternate between fiction and travel because I really believe they use different parts of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Fiction is a kind of constructive. There's two types of sculpture. You know, you can build up sculpture with clay and give it shape, or you can take a big block of stone and carve away everything that doesn't look like your subject.
Right.
And
right.
Travel writing is like marble. You have this huge... You go and you travel, you go to a country, you go to a region, you go to northern Newfoundland or Labrador, you go to Ireland or Japan, and you have all this material, and then you have to cut it down. Whereas fiction, I think you start with an idea or a character or something and you build up. So fiction is like clay sculpture and travel is like marble. So I do like to switch back and forth just to give my brain a break.
Does this mean you're going to start traveling again?
Yes, Ireland.
Oh,
I don't want to give it away, but Ireland.
Oh, the Emerald Isle.
Yes. I love going to Ireland because everybody looks like me. They've all got splotchy skin and they've got beards and they're stocky. I just fit right in. I love it.
And if I remember correctly, writers don't pay tax there.
Yes, I've been told this. Is this true?
That's what I've heard. I hear there's a movement to change it, but I hear that all artists don't pay income tax in Ireland.
Well, then what the hell are we doing here, Drew? Let's go. You get the tickets. I'll meet you at the airport.
I'll meet you on the 8:15 to Dublin.
Sounds good.
Cool. Nice talking with you, Will.
Good talking to you, Drew.
That's Will Ferguson in Calgary. Spanish Fly is published by Penguin. I'm Drew Hayden-Taylor sitting in for Sheila Rogers.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.